Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. There's no end to the pro-war movies we're subjected to. Countless celebrations of bombs, guns, and torture. They come in the form of cartoons, science fiction, historical fiction, dramas, and reenactments pre-censored by the CIA. Movies show us the excitement without the suffering. War in our theaters resembles almost anything else more than it resembles war. We can expect this to be the case with the Pentagon's new version of Superman coming out this summer. Journalists appear in our movies too, usually as comic figures, talking head, airheads, numbskulls, and sycophants. In this case, the depiction is, I'll admit, much more accurate, at least of much of what passes for journalism. But starting this week, in cities around the country, a remarkable anti-war, pro-journalism film will be showing, even more remarkably in big mainstream movie theaters. Dirty Wars. I have read the book and I have seen the movie and highly recommend them both. Maybe one of the best educational outreach opportunities the peace movement has had in a long time. The film, starring Jeremy Scahill, the author of the book, is about secretive aspects of U.S. wars. Imprisonment, torture, night raids, drone kills. Dirty Wars won the Cinematography Award for U.S. Documentary at the Sundance Film Festival this year, and recently the Grand Jury Prize at the Boston Independent Film Festival. Variety calls it jaw-dropping, with the power to pry open government lockboxes. The Sundance jury said it is, quote, one of the most stunning-looking documentaries we've ever seen, end quote. I agree. Typically, information that does not support our government's war agenda appears only on the printed page, or perhaps in a PowerPoint presented to the usual heroic crowd of aging white activists gathered outside the range of corporate radar. But stroll through an airport, and you'll see hard copies of Dirty Wars displayed at the front of the bookstores. Check out the movie listings this month and later this summer, and you're likely to see Dirty Wars listed right alongside the latest superhero murder fest sequel of a sequel of some predictable Hollywood hackery. I wrote a review of the book some time back, after which I picked up a job helping to promote the film. But I'm promoting the film because it's a great film, which is different from calling it a great film because I'm paid to promote it. And my interest remains less in selling the film tickets than in recruiting those who see the film into an active movement to change the reality on which the film reports. This is not Zero Dark Thirty. You can't walk into Dirty Wars supporting drone strikes, night raids, and cluster bombs and walk out with your beliefs reinforced. Most viewers of Dirty Wars will leave the theater believing that U.S. wars make the United States less safe. In that moment, when people who are usually otherwise engaged have come to realize that the Department of so-called Defense endangers us, on top of impoverishing us, is when we should sign those people up to take part in activities the following week and month and year. The film opens by contrasting embedded war journalism, the regurgitation of spoon-fed propaganda, with what the viewer is about to see, and what we see is investigative journalism. The film begins by providing us with an understanding of night raids, including from the point of view of family members who have survived them. We see the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff tell Scahill that night raids that kill civilians should not be investigated. And then we see Scahill investigate them, his search leading him to secretive branches of the U.S. military involved in a variety of dirty tactics in various countries. To tell us how and why this film was made, I'm delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio the film's director, Richard Rowley. He's a cinematographer. Over the course of 15 years, he has been the co-founder of Big Noise Films, has made multiple award-winning documentary features including Fourth World War and This Is What Democracy Looks Like. His shorts and news reports are also regularly featured on and commissioned by leading outlets including Al Jazeera, BBC, CBC, CNN, International, Democracy Now!, and PBS. Rowley is a co-founder of the Independent Media Center. He has been a Pulitzer Fellow, a Rockefeller Fellow, a Jerome Foundation Fellow, and a Sundance Documentary Film Program Fellow. Rick Rowley, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
So the film is absolutely terrific, Dirty Wars. Congratulations on producing what I think is an amazing piece of work. One of the earlier segments in the film deals with a night raid in Afghanistan and the family members of the victims of a night raid. How did you get involved in covering that incident?
Yeah, you know, when we began filming, Jeremy and I, 3 years ago in Afghanistan, we had no idea what the scale of this story would turn into. The film begins kind of as a mystery story. There's an embedded reporter who is trying to cover the war on the conventional side of the military and realizes that he's missing the war. That investigative reporter is Jeremy Scahill, of course, the one of the great investigative journalists of our time. So we disembed and try to track down these night raids that we hear rumors about, which seems to be where the covert war has begun to eclipse the conventional war. And we one of the night raids that we hear about happens in this village called Gardez, and it's particularly gruesome. There were two pregnant women were killed as part of the night raid, and we hear in the NATO press release that the combined Afghan-American force stumbled upon the Taliban honor killing. So they claim that this family that had Taliban members in it murdered their own pregnant daughters in this brutal, barbaric act, and that they just sort of stumbled on it, killed the Taliban, and captured a few prisoners. So Jeremy and I went out to investigate, and we discovered that nothing of the kind was true at all, that the Americans had probably been fed bad intelligence, and what they had rolled up on was a celebration. It was the sixth day after a child had been born, the grandparents had chosen a name, and it was a naming celebration. That is a traditional thing in Afghan culture. And the Americans rolled in, and they'd killed two pregnant women and a police commander and the chief prosecutor for Gardez. So very important Afghans who were fighting on the American side against the Taliban.
Had the British reporter Jerome Starkey already reported on the problems with the NATO story when you went out there or not?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was Jerome's reporting that alerted us that this was going on. That there was question has been raised, that the family had disputed NATO's account. Jerome Starkey is one of the best reporters was one of the best reporters in Afghanistan. He's since been promoted, and he's now covering Africa for the Times of London out of Cape Town. He's a great guy and a friend of ours. It was his account of it that brought us to Gardez in the first place with our film cameras. So it emerged over the course of the next month. There were a series of other investigations that happened that were, there was this internal UN investigation that was, it was never made public, but it was internal inside the UN organization there in Gardez. And there was an Afghan forensic investigation done by the Afghan police themselves. And these investigations determined what the family had told us, that the American troops dug the bullets out of the bodies of the pregnant women in order to cover up who had been responsible for the killing. And so after all these details emerged, finally NATO was forced to retract their story, and they admitted that they got it wrong. They admitted that that they had killed the women and that the men that they killed weren't, in fact, Taliban. So it seemed like the case was closed. We'd revealed the truth behind what had happened, that it was Americans that killed innocent Afghans, and it was not a raid on Taliban. It was not an honor killing. The family had not murdered their own daughters. But there was this photograph. A few days after the Americans changed their version of events, Jerome and his cameraman were down in the village with the family when a convoy of Afghan troops rolled up. And among them was an American admiral who no one knew at the time. Jerome didn't know who he was. Who came out and offered to sacrifice two sheep on the doorstep of this compound to apologize to the family for killing their loved ones. So the picture was of Admiral William McRaven, who at the time his name wasn't known publicly at all. He wasn't part of the NATO of the conventional force there at all. No one, at Bagram or in the regional command that controlled the East could tell us what he was doing there. But Jeremy, through his investigating, quickly discovered that Admiral William Raven now became famous because, of course, he was the head of the Joint Special Operations Command, the unit that killed bin Laden. So this is a unit, the most secretive unit inside the U.S. military that operates all over the world and that is responsible directly to the executive wing, to the president himself. It doesn't run through the conventional chain of command at all. So then a whole new investigation was open. Why was the president's elite force targeting farmers in the mountains of Afghanistan? I mean, not strategic opponents of the U.S., not terrorist masterminds, not doing hostage rescue missions that it was designed for, but fighting the sort of ground-level war against people who they thought were mid-level Taliban commanders in Afghanistan. So we tracked this unit around the world, and we went to other places off of any stated battlefield where JSOC was operating. So, when we began in Afghanistan, in Gardez, I never imagined that this story would take us to the streets of Mogadishu in Somalia or to Yemen. And when we began interviewing Afghan victims of JSOC, I never thought that we would end the film interviewing American citizens whose family members had also been targeted by the same unit.
It's an incredible development as the story rolls along, but that initial segment in Afghanistan is interesting just as a film production, because you've got the photographs, you've got your own footage of Jeremy speaking with the family members, and you've got cell phone footage that apparently some of the victims' family members shot of JSOC members, of Americans surveying the damage the next day. And as Jeremy puts it in the film, getting their story together on how they would tell the tale. How did you put that all together?
Yeah, it was really amazing. I mean, all of these clues were not supposed to exist. I mean, this is a unit that is supposed to not officially be operating there, that is completely clandestine, that no one discloses anything about. And so we investigated, half a dozen other raids, where we heard incredibly compelling stories from families that we believed about things like this happening in other places. But in Gardez, there happened to have survived enough forensic evidence on the ground. It was a photograph here or a cell phone video there that we could nail the story in a way that was absolutely airtight and that would, we could prove it without any doubt. So, the cell phone video is particularly chilling. It's some brave Afghan, I don't know who, surreptitiously recorded the bodies early in the morning after the raid had happened, and you hear these American accented voices talking over this footage. And for a moment, you see their hands in the tape, and a video camera in their hands as they collect their own sort of images to support their story, where they're concocting this version of events that will match up with their. With what they ultimately reported up the chain, which is that it was an honor killing. So it's really chilling. I mean, we don't see their faces. We hear their voices and we see their hands. And then we have a picture of an admiral who no one can tell us where he's from. And just with those little bits, we were able to, we pull on the string and it leads to the wall and turns into this massive, massive story that continent.
You also have footage that you shot of one of the little girls who survived, who had lost parents and loved ones in this night raid, and listing the names of the dead. It's striking to have that footage in U.S. movie theaters, and one wonders, what if this little girl were treated as being as valuable as the little kids in a school in Connecticut in a shooting or any other incident that we do find this sort of national obsession and empathy with? Is it part of your hope that that people begin to relate to these victims of our wars in these places?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, film, one of the things that film does better than any other medium, and the reason why I love film and why I've devoted my life to it, is that it allows people to feel a human connection to other people who they see on screen, who they might be separated from by massive, cultural and geographic distance. This war, this longest war in American history, the global war on terror, we're only ever allowed to see it from cameras embedded with American troops, or from cameras mounted on the noses of bombs, or on some weaponized aerial platform, a helicopter or a drone. I mean, we see Afghans as little gray specks before they disappear in a puff of smoke. The cameras are almost never on the other side of that whole military and media apparatus. So a big part of our goal is to try to show the humanity and the life of people who are really living on the front lines of these wars. These are the civilians in Afghanistan, the Bedouins in rural Yemen who live under the drones, under the sound of the drones every day, in Pakistan. And so that is, Yeah, that's absolutely one of our hopes, to make these people and these stories human.
It's interesting also how many viewpoints you got from the U.S. side, from members or former members of the U.S. military and people involved in these operations who talk about kill lists that grow. As the people are killed, the lists grow longer because, of course, you're enraging friends and relatives and neighbors as you kill people. And you even have the story of Anwar al-Awlaki and include some stunning footage from just after September 11th from U.S. media, in which he was then depicted as a moderate imam who was sympathetic to U.S. victims of this tragedy and so forth, and you describe a story of his turning against the United States, his transformation as a result of U.S. actions. It seems to me that one of the messages people are going to take away from this movie, if they have any open mind whatsoever, is that the wars make us less safe rather than making us more safe.
Yeah, you know, I mean, after covering this for a long time, and for over a decade, I've been covering the war, you know, all over the region and the world. I mean, Iraq for many, many years, and Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia, all over other countries in East Africa and in the Middle East. And I'm absolutely convinced that we are creating more enemies in these strikes than we are killing terrorists. And yeah, I mean, a lot of people in the military, I mean, first of all, Jeremy is an amazing investigative reporter and is able to cultivate relationships with people who are in the inside of these units at the same time that he's able to cultivate relationships with civilians in Yemen and Afghanistan and the other side of that. I think a unique thing about him as a reporter, about the book and about the film, is that the film really shows, you know, spans both sides of the story. But a lot of these guys are feeling inside the units, inside the CIA, inside JSOC and the conventional military, see the same problem. Andrew Rexon, the Army Ranger who's in the film, who you referred to, I mean, said, in Iraq, we began with a deck of cards with 55 people on a kill list. And you can work your way through a list of 50 or 200 guys. But when we got to the end of those lists, they gave us a new list with 3,000 people on it. And, you know, how do these lists grow? They grow because in the operations that kill the tiny group of leadership, you know, more enemies are built. I mean, there's this myth and this idea that you can kill your way to victory, that there's a finite amount of bad guys out there who are just bad, and when you kill them, everything is going to be fine. And that's an incredibly cartoonish view of how the world actually functions. I mean, these strikes, the backlash against the drone strikes, targeted killings and assassinations in places like Yemen and Somalia are turning these countries into terrifying places. They're empowering jihadists, the very jihadists that we say that we're trying to oppose. So, you know, on September 11th, Al-Qaeda was a small organization, and it was on the run. It didn't have any territory. It didn't have a home base. Now, more than a decade into the war, billions of dollars spent, thousands of American troops lost, hundreds of thousands of civilians killed around the world, and Al-Qaeda is a larger organization than it was then. It was just tens of thousands of people, and they control swaths of territory in the Horn of Africa, now in West Africa now, in Yemen. So even if you don't have moral problems with the killing of civilians, even if you don't have political problems with the way that our civil liberties have been curtailed back home, strategically, it's been profoundly counterproductive. And a lot of people inside the military and out of it are waking up to the fact that we can be tactically brilliant, and we can, carry out a surgical strike like, you know, killing Bin Laden or whatever. We can be tactically brilliant and have tactical success and strategic failure. So these assassinations have turned, I think, into a tactic without a strategy. There's just no end game here. One of the operators we talked about this process as mowing the lawn. Like, you wait for insurgency or jihadism to rise up beyond a certain point, and then you chop off all of the leadership at the head of it, knowing that the grass is going to grow back thicker the more you mow it, and that is there is no end game. You're permanently managing a situation of violence and instability. And you see in a place like Somalia that's gone through a couple of decades of warlord rule and covert war, what that does to a place. It turns it into a terrifying, terrifying place.
It seems that the film and the book are perhaps inspiring additional whistleblowers. There was a member of JSOC who spoke at an event we organized in Washington, D.C. on Saturday of our opening weekend, who was speaking out for the first time about his participation and was asking not to be applauded for his complicity in these sorts of crimes. And he talked about Jeremy's book and the film as being part of what encouraged him to speak out. It's a tremendous opportunity, I think, to have this tool in theaters and in bookstores. I've heard some criticism of the focus on Jeremy as the star of the film and making him into a hero. And my initial response has been, you know, we've got 20 films every week making soldiers into heroes. We ought to have an anti-war hero. Why not? But what's your thinking, and how did you decide to shape the story of the film around Jeremy's reporting?
Well, we never wanted to make Jeremy a hero. We want Jeremy to be a surrogate for the viewer. You know, we're traveling around to a lot of weaving together very remote locations that are all, you know, an archipelago of violence: Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan. And so Jeremy is a character through which the audience is supposed to identify with, and through which they're able to emotionally engage with the people that they meet in these places. You know, when we began, Jeremy was going to be in it as sort of a tour guide, and we, you know, worked on the film for 2 years with the idea that he would just be this sort of surface level narrator. And then in the last year of post-production, we started to work with the great fiction director and writer, David Riker, who's a very good friend of ours, who helped us to realize that we were missing half the story. And at that point, we had a film that was a blistering expose of this exterior war, about the way that the war was being fought in Somalia and Yemen and you know, in the world outside the United States. But there was a second half to the story, which was how this war is changing us as a country and as a people. And so Jeremy then needed to be the vehicle through which the audience is allowed to feel a connection to the victims of this war that he sees on the ground overseas, in a way that they're allowed to feel the impact of this war on us back home. So, you know, the film wouldn't work without him. But I don't think people should think of him as a hero. They should think of him as their representative, as their proxy, as the vehicle through which they're introduced to and allowed to experience the world with the Afghan, Somali, and Yemeni civilians who they meet along the way.
Well, it is my fervent hope that millions and millions of people in this country and around the world do just that. It's a remarkable film. Rick Rowley is the director of Dirty Wars. Rick, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
If the film Dirty Wars has any shortcoming, it is that it doesn't tell people any action to take, any group to join, anything they can do about the horrors they've just been exposed to. But of course, activism is possible and far more effective than any journalism, good or bad, will tell you. One of the stories told in the film and the book of Dirty Wars is the story of the destruction of Al-Majla. On December 17, 2009, U.S. Tomahawk missiles and incendiary cluster bombs rained down on the tiny Yemeni village of Al-Majla, killing 21 children, 14 women, and 6 men, and burning all the homes and their contents. The government of Yemen falsely claimed responsibility. Yemeni journalist Abdulela Haider Shaya disproved that claim. Shaya reported on the carnage, including photographing missile parts labeled Made in the United States. He reported on subsequent U.S. strikes in Yemen, working with the Washington Post, ABC News, Al Jazeera, and other outlets. Shaya is in prison in Yemen for the crime of journalism at the insistence of President Obama. A coalition has launched a petition urging Obama and Yemen to set Shaya free. Fans of Dirty Wars who want to begin to do something to end the crimes committed in their names can go to rootsaction.org and sign that petition, which will be delivered to the U.S. government and to the Yemeni government and to the U.S. ambassador to Yemen in person in Yemen. While the United States was searching for its citizen, Anwar Awlaki, to kill him, Shaya repeatedly tracked him down and interviewed him. These were tough and serious interviews, with Shaya asking Awlaki how he could possibly support acts of violence. Awlaki's image was not helped. But the U.S. government began warning media outlets not to work with Shaya, falsely accusing him of supporting Al-Qaeda. The Yemeni government kidnapped Shaya, threatened and released him, then snatched him again and gave him a one-sided, so-called trial, universally denounced as a sham by human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. On February 2, 2011, Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh, under public pressure, had drawn up, printed out, and was prepared to sign a pardon for Shaya. But Saleh received a phone call from President Barack Obama, who opposed release of the journalist. Saleh ripped up the pardon. The White House is feeling a little pressure over recent revelations of government spying on and seeking the prosecution of U.S. journalists, not to mention the entire U.S. public. It took the targeting of a U.S. journalist for prosecution to start people like Chuck Todd and Dana Milbank chattering about Obama treating journalism as a crime. But have you heard U.S. media outlets raising concerns over the imprisonment of a Yemeni journalist at the instruction of the U.S. president? There is much else that we are not regularly told to be found in dirty wars. Organizations that would like to help promote this film and organize around it in U.S. cities should go to davidswanson.org and contact me. With any luck, together we will change the conversation to one aware of and unaccepting of acts of murder anywhere on Earth. To learn more about Dirty Wars and to get involved in any way, go to dirtywars.org. To learn more than the film can include, read the book, the focus of which is on operations that were once more secretive than they are today. Kidnapping, rendition, secret imprisonment, torture, and assassination. Quote, "This is a story," reads the first sentence of the book, quote, "about how the United States came to embrace assassination as a central part of its national security policy." Scahill combines publicly available information with his own original reporting, much of which he has written and spoken about before, to create the best history we have of how the practice I call murder by president evolved from tiny origins in the Clinton White House to weekly Terror Tuesday meetings for Obama. Without the need for any commentary from the author, a number of themes emerge, I think, through the telling of events and the repetition of the same sorts of horrors and blunders. 1. The U.S. government vastly overestimates its power and conceives of its power as physical force. 2. The use of such force in Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, Afghanistan tends to make matters worse and create situations that, by the same analysis, require much more force, which thankfully isn't always used. 3. Revenge and machismo sometimes motivate actions publicly depicted as geopolitical strategy or humanitarianism. 4. The United States government lies frequently and sometimes begins to believe its own lies. 5. The U.S. corporate media takes very little offense at being lied to. 6. Nothing you think the CIA might try to do could be dumber than some of the things it actually tries. And 7. Uses of power that are permitted will be engaged in increasingly if left unchecked. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.